KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint. K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove. KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay. KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass. And KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
We've got music from every flavor, so keep it tuned on 91.9 on that FM dial where you can turn on, tune in, and jam out.
Hey to all you fish enthusiasts out there. Whether you're an avid angler or just curious about fish, we'd like to welcome you to Fish of the Week, your audio almanac of all the fish. It's Monday, May 19th, 2025, and we're on a week-by-week tour of fish across the country with guests from all walks of life. I'm Katrina Labick with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and my co-host is Guy Arrow.
And this week we're talking about a small, special, shiny, silvery fish, the Rio Grande silvery minnow.
And we've got two U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biologists with us today. Andy Dean is with our New Mexico Ecological Services Field Office, and Thomas Archdeacon is with our New Mexico Fish and Wildlife Conservation Office. So thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Okay, so based on the name, I think we can all make some guesses about what the fish looks like and where it's from. But I'd love if one of you could just kind of orient us on the map as to where we're going to see this fish. And if one of you could then describe what the fish looks like if we had it in our hand. Is there anything kind of special about any features that could help us distinguish it from some other silvery little fish?
Sure. I'll go ahead and give you a little bit of a background about where this fish lives, and then I'll pass it off to Thomas since he's had fish in his hand more recently than I have. Historically, this fish did exist in the Rio Grande from north central New Mexico all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. It currently occupies only about 5 to 7% of its historical habitat, and that area is called the Middle Rio Grande. You might hear us refer to the Middle Rio Grande as the MRG. The MRG exists from Cochiti Dam, which is just a little bit north of Albuquerque, down to Elephant Butte Reservoir, which is close to Truth or Consequences in south central New Mexico. So about 155 to 170-ish miles of the Rio Grande.
Okay. And then what does it look like?
It's pretty nondescript. It's 2 to 3 inches long. A really large one might be 4 inches long. And like its name, it's pretty silvery. There's a lot of really colorful fish in North America, and it is not one of them beyond being really silvery. If you talk to anglers, they just lump everything in as a minnow. That's a pretty good description. It just looks like a minnow. It's just a small fish. It's pretty silvery. You know, if you want to get into the fine details of the taxonomy, there are a lot of things to look for. But, you know, if you just drew the outline of kind of a slender fish and made it silver, that would be a pretty good representation of a silvery minnow. I'll just add, there's a bunch of different species within that genus, and they all are almost identical looking. 7 or 8 species. One is actually called brassy minnow, and it is a little bit different color, but you have eastern, western, Mississippi, and Rio Grande silvery minnow, and a plains minnow, and all 5 of those are almost identical.
I know the Rio Grande only in sort of 2 places, up in the mountains in Colorado where it's a trout stream, and then further down when it gets into kind of Big Bend National Park. And those are 2 very different habitats. And so you're mentioning this Middle Rio Grande, and so I'm curious what that looks like today, and if that's what it's always looked like, or if it's undergone some changes over the years.
Historically, it was a really wide river, braided, not very deep, similar to what you would probably see closer to Big Bend. The classic adage that people say, it was 1 mile wide and 1 inch deep. So very sand-laden system. And today, it is contracted to almost a single stream thread, still not very deep, but is confined on both riverbanks by a lot of vegetation, cottonwoods, willows, salt cedar, putting levees on both sides to control flooding for the different municipalities along the river. But it's gone through a lot of changes. We're now constricted to a single thread stream throughout most of the Middle Rio Grande.
So that's very different from what these fish evolved in, and I'm kind of curious, in a similar vein, what the fish community structure was, like what other species historically were in there, and then how that looks today.
That's a really good question because, you know, I think the description Andy gave is really spot on. And despite these changes, the Middle Rio Grande is probably still the most natural looking, which makes sense because this is the only place the silvery minnow is still found. About the mid-20th century, so like 1950s, before that, there were a whole suite of species that kind of had the same reproductive strategy that Rio Grande silvery minnow has. And it is, they just release their eggs straight into the water column, and then those sort of drift slowly downstream. all the other species that do that have already been lost. Rio Grande bluntnose shiner, speckled chub, the Rio Grande shiner, and those have all been extirpated. And one is actually extinct, the phantom shiner. Worldwide, finding a freshwater minnow that has non-adhesive eggs that they don't build a nest or anything is pretty rare.
Typically, you talk about pelagic spawning species and you're talking about reef fish and coral, and you don't typically talk about something that lives in a desert river, a sandbed river, that is a pelagic spawning species.
You know, to us, we kind of think like, oh, it's normal, but it's because this is where they are and you get outside this basin and it's extremely rare.
That is cool.
Why has the Rio Grande silver minnow been able to kind of hold on, whereas all these other species have been lost? Is there anything special about it, or was it just always sort of the most abundant and it's the last to fall?
I think that's kind of a million-dollar question, because either the same species or a very similar species occurs in the Pecos River, and they are all hanging on except for silvery minnow, which was extirpated because plains minnow got into there and outcompeted them. So if you wanted me to just kind of take a wild guess, it might be because they're so affected by droughts and low flow that there may have been a period where there were several years of extreme low flows in a row. And I think silvery minnows might actually live just slightly a bit longer than those other species. Where those other ones live 1 to 2 years, they might live 2 to 3 years. And it just perhaps allowed them to get through. There's also a lot we don't know about the Pecos River fishes. They seem to be spawning throughout the entire summer, whereas silvery minnow seems to be really tied to just the spring runoff. And their spawning window is late April through early June. And the Pecos River fish that have the same kind of reproductive strategy seem to be spawning through maybe even through September.
So these fish were all kind of really cute and spawning based on flow?
At least the silvery minnow, yes. In the Pecos, I think we don't have as much data on the reproductive biology, so it's hard to say if they would have acted the same way when they were still in the Pecos. Like, they were extirpated in, I think, 1968, so there's just no data on what Rio Grande silvery minnow were doing in the Pecos.
In the Middle Rio Grande, you can look at the spring hydrograph and see that spring runoff pulse happening. And Thomas has done some work back calculating spawn dates. It's like a one-to-one relationship. You see that spring pulse come up, and you know the fish are spawning. Another reason why they might have hung on in the Middle Rio Grande is because this seems a little bit counterintuitive, but there are a lot of people here in the Middle Rio Grande, and there is a lot of irrigation. But because most of the population in New Mexico is along the Rio Grande, they try to keep water in the river as much as possible, especially after the species was listed. The river does dry in the summer almost every single year, typically in the southern or downstream reaches, but they do try to maintain some flow in this section of the Rio Grande, which might have allowed this fish to hang on a little bit longer than the other species as well.
And you mentioned they're listed, so listed under the Endangered Species Act.
They were listed in 1994 as endangered.
So it sounds like there's much less flow than there typically was. How much of that is due to human management in the system versus just changes in snowpack and rainfall and precipitation?
That's a really good question. It's really probably a really complex answer. So I would say the flow regime really changed from what it was historically because of the storage for irrigation. So that will change the spring runoff because they're going to be storing during peak flows. And they will also use cochineas flood control if there's, you know, extreme flows, because they don't want to blow out people's property. So you may see throttling back. In extremely rare cases, that might actually benefit the fish by blocking up a bunch of water that gets released at a slower time. But in most cases, it doesn't really help the fish because they're going to be storing in upstream dams. Because there's been a lot of groundwater pumping, the water table is much lower. So that kind of exacerbates the drying that occurs in the spring and summer and fall. Whereas smaller amounts of water probably kept it continuous through the summer in probably all but the extreme drought years. And this is thinking back like 400 or 500 years, you know, periods of no flow are pretty rare until the 1890s. And then they start becoming more and more and more common. And now we're seeing periods of no flow every single year. And part of that is just because the groundwater has been severed from the river. So you start cranking back surface flows and very quickly you start to see drying, whereas smaller amounts of water may have been able to keep things perennial 100 to 200 years ago.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a cumulative effect too, right? You have a lot of people taking water from the river, affecting surface flows. Like Thomas said, there's a disconnect with the groundwater. There's also something called the low flow conveyance channel, which essentially drains the river to some degree. So also disconnecting from the water table. But then the climate effects too. We are seeing a lot less snowpack in any given year. This system is almost solely driven by snowpack because we're not seeing a lot of spring runoff or sustained runoff throughout the year. We're seeing really extensive drying that, you know, didn't really start until probably mid-20th century, late 20th century.
Okay. What are some of the things you're doing out of your offices or with other Fish and Wildlife Service facilities to help recover this fish, kind of given this flow situation in the background?
Yeah, there's two major projects, and Andy may jump in with some other ones. There's a long-term monitoring program, and we use that information to kind of figure out if there was a kind of a poor recruitment year, if there wasn't a lot of reproduction going on, how many hatchery fish do we want to add back into the system in the fall? That's just to bolster the population in case the following year is actually a good runoff year, because we don't want to end up in a situation where there's too few fish out there to spawn the following year. And then the other one is this fish rescue idea, where we go out and remove the fish from the isolated pools that are going to dry. And then either we bring them into captivity or remove them somewhere that we think it's not going to dry. You get this idea that it dries from downstream to upstream. It's just this clean drying, and it's not, because there's a lot of irrigation return flows, wastewater treatment plants. Sometimes the groundwater table is a little bit higher. So it becomes really disjointed, and you have, you know, multiple segments of drying with intervening perennial flows in between. So those are the two major ones. And then there's habitat restoration. But I don't know if Andy has any other thoughts on that.
There are some big habitat projects happening in the downstream section of the Middle Rio Grande, realigning the river to a lower point in the valley, because during that 1950s time, the river was moved around a lot to prevent flooding and get water off of people's property, essentially. Now, because we're seeing so much drying, we're trying to figure out ways to try to keep water in the river. So Bureau of Reclamation and the Interstate Stream Commission are working together to realign the river to a lower elevation in the valley so we can try to preserve as much water as possible in those drier months. Other cool projects, I think, are what we call a jiggle, which is we've worked with all of our partners. And when we're seeing years where we don't have a lot of snowpack and the spring runoff is going to be minimal, we try to mimic or create a spring runoff pulse. In order to get the fish to spawn, we'll do a timed release of X number of CFS, cubic feet per second, to see if we can mimic that spring pulse and get the fish to spawn.
How much flow above base flow is required to induce this spawning push?
If you want it to result in recruitment, you know, successful reproduction, those fish actually hatch and survive till October or November, it needs to be like 3,000 CFS for 2 or 3 weeks. And, you know, base flows are probably 500 to 600 in the winter. That's an incredible volume of water. And that's related to what Andy was talking about earlier. Channels become more incised and confined. So to actually create these slow velocity habitats that the larval fish need, you have to put more water down. You'd think it'd be the opposite, but it's because it's disconnected from the floodplain. So you need these large volumes of water to connect the floodplain, create the habitats that you want for these fish. But what we found is that if you have extremely low base flows, like say 100 CFS, and you just bump it up for a little bit, sometimes fish respond to that kind of out of desperation, I guess. It does work to trigger them to spawn, but those eggs will just be lost. They won't end up in the right habitats.
Weird question. Do you think beavers could help?
Beavers are always the answer, in my opinion. But in this scenario, they don't build the dams for us. They're bank-dwelling beavers, so they don't really help us out with connecting anything to groundwater or the floodplain.
Okay. So, no, beavers strike out this time. Sorry.
Unfortunately, yes.
How did the jiggle go this year? Has it happened yet? Or will it happen?
It did happen. My opinion is it was a little bit too early. You know, they did it because this was the only shot. They weren't going to be able to hold off and try to do it a little bit later. Mm-hmm. So they did spawn, and we got around 1,500 eggs. But in years where it works really, really well, we'll get over 100,000. I think even in the early 2000s, they were approaching 1 million eggs sometimes.
Okay.
And the conditions that allow for collections like that just have not occurred for, you know, many years.
How does that actually work? So you go out in the field, you collect these eggs. Can you kind of walk us through how you do that and then where they go and what happens then?
These fish typically spawn in May, but when we're working with something like the jiggle, we'll go out there when we see discharge start to increase, and we go out with what are called more egg collectors, and it's basically a open-ended box with a screen on the back, and water flows in through the open end of the box. They're semi-buoyant eggs, so they're kind of floating in the middle of the water column, and when they hit the screen, they just kind of roll up to the surface of the water, and we scoop them out, put them in cups, and when we have enough, we'll put them in a bag on some oxygen and send them off to our hatcheries.
The more egg collector is named after an ichthyologist. He filtered the water and realized there were eggs rolling downstream. And so the Albuquerque Biopark actually came up with this box and named the more egg collector after him. And it is literally just a window screen in the water, and the eggs roll in and they'll roll to the top of the screen and you can pick them up with a spoon.
Okay.
That's cool.
I guess I got two questions. One's just a follow-up on this. How do you know where to go? I mean, I know it's a kind of restricted system and these fish don't live everywhere now, but it's still, they are found in like, what, 200 miles of stream, I believe, right? So how do you know where to go to make sure that you're getting the eggs or getting the most eggs? How do you choose your site selection to put this window screen in the water?
I think the first choice is how far do you have to walk carrying all these T-post stuff? So closer is better. And then if it's a medium or high flow year, are you going to be able to stand in the river? In a year like this, it doesn't matter. You can go anywhere and you're going to barely be able to be waist deep. But in some years, it could be, you know, almost over my head, or at least right next to the bank, it's over your head. So that's not going to be a good spot. But because the eggs are just floating downstream, it almost doesn't matter where you go. I guess the third criteria would be I would look at the previous year's data from our fish rescue and try to guess where either we released a bunch of hatchery fish or we think that there's a bunch of wild fish. But in general, it's going to be really dictated by, can we get to the river? Can we get close to the river? Can we get our equipment in? And can we put it in safely without topping our waders and getting pushed downstream? Because even if you can stand in it, sometimes the flows, the velocity is so high that it'll just start pushing your equipment over and you have to constantly shift it around and put it back into the sand.
Yeah.
Oh, gotcha.
We do have an egg collection monitoring program that a consultant in town does, and groups from the biopark as well, and Fish and Wildlife Service and others will go out and throw one of these egg collectors in the water at different places throughout the Middle Rio Grande. And when people start collecting eggs, it's a phone call and a mad dash to get as many people out there as possible to see how many eggs you can get.
That's cool. Good teamwork.
I don't know if you've ever seen it where somebody's catching thousands of eggs an hour in one location and no eggs in another location. So there is sort of this like synchronous spawning that's going on. And as long as you're in the flow pulse, you'll probably be getting eggs regardless of exactly where you are.
For the jiggles, we really just follow the pulse downstream and collect eggs as it's moving through the system.
So once you collect the eggs, you've got them in your oxygenated bags, and you mentioned hatcheries. Which hatcheries are these, and then what happens?
There's three facilities, the Old Silver Minnow, and use them for our augmentation program. There's the Albuquerque Biopark, which is funded by the Albuquerque Bernalillo County Water Utility Authority. It's like part of the aquarium and the zoo. They are the easiest because they're the closest, and they have enough staff that they also send their own people out. So sometimes it's just a matter of handing off the bag to them in the field. There's another facility in Los Lunas that's like 30 miles south of Albuquerque. They are often out as well. They usually use a contractor and they collect their own eggs. And then the National Fish Hatchery, the Southwestern Native Aquatic Resources Recovery Center in Dexter, New Mexico, they are the largest facility by far. If we were to collect something like 200,000 or 300,000 eggs, we would send them to that facility. Usually what happens is if it's a morning where we're getting a lot of eggs, we'll do a couple timed counts to get an estimate of how many we think we're going to get. And if it's going to be over 10,000 or something, we'll give those guys a call and see if they can get a driver ready so that they can meet us somewhere. We'll just have a agreed upon time to stop and take them what we have. In other cases, sometimes they don't have a driver and one of us drives over there. Depending on where we are, it's 2 to 3 hours one way and then 3 hours back to Albuquerque. So it can make for some long days.
What's the survivorship from egg to adult, or at whatever stage you would look to put them back in the river?
And the hatcheries, they usually come up with an estimate that about 60 to 65% are fertilized, and then about 80% of those live. So you can roughly just cut the number of eggs in half, and that will be what it's available. And in the early years when we were collecting, you know, hundreds of thousands of eggs, we were doing exactly what you're suggesting, is raising them up and then they would go back to the river at the fall. Since we haven't been able to get those huge numbers of eggs, these wild caught ones now become the brood stock that are on station at the hatcheries, come from wild caught eggs, and then their offspring are what's returned to the river.
Okay, so you can actually have these guys spawn in captivity then?
Yes, so they let them just kind of naturally develop in the ponds till right about now, and then they bring them in, and They inject them with carp pituitary extract, which kind of pushes them over the edge and makes them spawn basically overnight.
I'm wrapping my head around all of this. Is the reason for continuing to go back to the wild just to try and get like new genetics in, or you know, robust genetics in, so you don't just get a bunch of inbreed? But it sounds like you got tons of fish that could be used as broodstock, like potentially tens of thousands.
Yeah, you're exactly right. It's to refresh the genetics. The augmentation program worked better when it was returning those wild-caught eggs directly back to the river rather than using them as broodstock. And the issue is that, you know, a lot of the genetics look pretty similar, but you're only using 300 to 400 females to produce 300,000 offspring. You still have kind of a bottleneck there. Even though maybe those 300 females are really representative, you would really prefer to maybe use like 10,000 females and then just randomly select from those millions of offspring which ones go back to the river, but that's just not a feasible thing to do.
Just space limited.
Space limited, and at this point we don't have thousands and thousands of broodstock to choose from anymore. So we're in a position where I think there's less than 3,000 probably truly wild caught as eggs or wild caught as larvae that are in hatcheries right now.
Yeah, the last few years have been interesting because we've either had an amazing spring runoff and people couldn't get into the river to collect eggs because discharge was too high. And then we go into 2 years later, a year like this year, where we don't have any snowpack and we're not going to have a natural spring runoff. So there aren't any eggs to collect, which is why we try those jiggles. So getting fish from the wild is twofold right now. One, because we're running into almost an emergency of captive broodstock and having refuge populations, and then augmenting the genetics for things that we do spawn in the hatcheries.
Are people in this area familiar with this fish, and what are their thoughts, if you know about them?
Yeah, I think people are pretty familiar with it. And okay. I think it depends on how you view water use. Is how you feel about it.
I guess I'd be curious how you would market this fish, or is there a value or values that people should be thinking about with it?
One thing I tell people a lot is if they want to continue to enjoy a river that flows through Albuquerque and other cities, then you should be doing everything you can to help protect the minnow, because it's really kind of the last saving grace of keeping water in the river year round. You know, if we didn't have endangered species, you know, we have several birds and a mouse, and the monarch was petitioned for listening to, which it exists in New Mexico. But having the minnow in the river is the biggest assurance of keeping water in the river.
So if there's no minnow, there's not going to be incentive to put that water in there or keep it in there.
There'd be a very, very low incentive, yeah. The amount of responses that we get from some of the kids that come out to learn about our threatened and endangered species and release a minnow into the river is, what is that? I've never seen that fish before. Where did it come from? And we're often right next to the Rio Grande, and some of these kids didn't even know that there's a river that flows through town. So I would say some of the responses we get when we talk about fish is, again, like, why do we care? And cool, can I touch one? And do they live here all the time?
Speaking of outreach and stuff, y'all remember back that lake sturgeon, like the Detroit River or the St. Clair River? Didn't one
big one?
Yeah, and they had like the picture of the lady laying down next to it. Didn't someone down with one of your guys' office, like, you know what I'm talking about, Thomas?
Yeah, that was me, and it was one of my technicians. I said he was really into photography, and I just asked, oh, could you put me in this? And I mean, he did it so perfectly because he literally just cut me out and pasted me right over the top half of that person. Like, it was the cheesiest but most perfect. Yeah, that was me.
Okay. I was looking for it before I got on here. I was going to do like a virtual background, but I couldn't find it online anywhere. It's a good photo. Now to my actual real question, though. I guess I'm curious. So it seems like this stretch of the river is kind of in dire straits, but you mentioned like there's flow that comes back into it lower down in the drainage. This fish used to live throughout a much larger extent of the Rio Grande. So why is it that it's only holding on in this seemingly really rough stretch of river and not further down? Is it even worse further down? Are there other issues? Why is it extirpated there?
Yeah, it's worse further down below Caballo. You know, Elephant View and Caballo are the reservoirs on the lower end, and the water gets turned off completely in those. And when you do that, not only does it, you know, fish need water to live, but it really modifies the habitat as well. So even if they started putting water back in there, it's just not a good habitat. You know, there's more to fish habitat than just water.
Does the Rio Grande still reach the Gulf?
It does, but there's big sections before Big Bend that are dry probably 6 or 8 months out of the year. from basically between Elephant Butte and El Paso, it's dry a lot of the times. And then even as flows coming out of the Conchas are less reliable, like there's big stretches down there. And then you get like, there's those big reservoirs in Texas. I think flows are more reliable there, but now the habitat is so, so different from what it would have been historically.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, between Caballo and El Paso is dry basically the whole irrigation season. So anywhere from April or May all the way through to October. And people around Las Cruces, which is in that section of dry river, they'll go to the river at the end of the irrigation season and the banks will just be lined with people and they have like a little party when the water comes back.
Oh, man.
Huh. That's kind of sad.
So you mentioned a handful of native minnows, many of which have gone or they've really declined. Do we have any idea like how many it used to be? Like, you know, how many fish were there in the system and were there any other kind of bigger species?
Yeah, I mean, we could kind of take a guess. There's some population models that would suggest that even today in the good years, you might be able to top 10 million for the middle Rio Grande. And conversely, in the poor years, there's as few as maybe a couple thousand, like definitely under 10,000. So you can have these huge, huge population rebounds and have numbers in the millions and go all the way down to those really low numbers. So drawing the parallels to the Pecos River as a whole, that fish assemblage, you would have caught a fish every time you did a seine haul that was at least a member of that kind of group. Even in the Pecos, which has its own problems, if you go in the summer following spawning, you know, it's hard to not catch fish there. And that is probably how it was here too. There is probably blue catfish and that's really about it. There were sturgeon and eels, but there's no bass, no pike or anything like that that were native that would have been munching down on these smaller fish. Just those catfish. And I don't think it's really well known how far upstream they made it. I think you have to look at like the archaeological sites to figure out and identify the bones, get some sort of estimate on how far they went. You know, there weren't really any surveys until the late 1800s.
Okay. It must have been pretty impressive, I imagine.
Yeah, I would think so. Just this giant sand river that was just full of fish.
Some folks that I've talked to from some of the pueblos that say they used to come into the river and trap an ungodly amount of fish. And they were calling them silvery minnows. Whether or not they were silvery minnow or not, we have no idea. But there used to be a lot more fish in the system than there are now.
What were they trapping and using the silvery minnows for?
Mainly to eat.
Would they make like a soup?
I don't know how they would eat them, but yeah, they say it was a huge food source for them.
I'd eat
them.
Years ago.
You ate one, Katrina?
No, I'd eat one if they weren't endangered or threatened.
Well, okay, well, that's actually a good point. That's not what I was going to ask, but how are the other Hibernathus doing? Like, it seems like this one's not doing well. What about the other species? Are they doing all right?
Some of them, it's real mixed. I'm not real familiar with the eastern species. But the western species, western silvery minnow, plains minnow, neither is doing very well, except that you have an introduced population of plains minnow in the Pecos River that's doing quite well. But in its native range, it's not doing very well. And I think similarly, the western silvery minnow is also not doing very well. Mississippi and eastern silvery minnow, brassy minnow, I couldn't speak on those.
All right. Well, maybe you can eat one of those non-native introduced plains minnows, Katrina. So these other fish that used to co-occur in the middle Rio Grande with the Rio Grande silvery minnow, has there been any talks about trying to reintroduce them now that they've been extirpated? Or would that be just throwing money down a hole that isn't worth it to try and reintroduce these fishes?
I'm curious about it because I still wonder about, was it like the 1950s where there was extreme drought? Was that what did it? You know, if it was a slow decline, it's probably not worth bringing them back. But if there was just one extreme event that wiped them all out, maybe it is worth bringing them back. But I don't think we don't know the answer to that. Sure, I would love to bring, it'd be really nice to have Rio Grande shiners in the Rio Grande, but we don't.
We're thinking about it though. Don't throw them out yet. It's not off the table. I think it'd be super awesome to have some shovel-nosed sturgeon back in here. But
Oh, yeah.
I think a lot of people see the effort that's going towards silvery minnow and they wonder, you know, why would we try to put any more effort and money into reintroducing other fish in here if we're already spending so much time on a minnow?
Yeah. I wonder if those were actually shovel-nosed sturgeon or not. Because I always think of shovel-nosed as being, you know, like Mississippi. I'm curious, when did they lose shovel-nosed sturgeon? Do we have any genetic samples? I know this isn't a sturgeon episode.
You can morph into a sturgeon episode if you want.
I don't think that they were ever common. You know, the strange thing is you would think that silvery minnow's closest relative would be plains minnow because it's the next basin over, but it's actually Mississippi silvery minnow is its closest relative.
Really?
Yeah.
So I know we have the Gulf there and that they're disconnected now. Sea levels used to be lower, though. Did the Rio Grande used to flow into the Mississippi before it got to the ocean? What's the hydrological history with this?
There was a connection between the Pecos and the Mississippi drainage through, I think, the Brazos or the Canadian River. So they probably came from one of those two, which mm-hmm. would have been Mississippi drainage, got into the Pecos, and then went downstream to the mainstem Rio Grande and then back up.
Okay, so it may have been like a transfer, like a headwater type transfer type thing. Okay, that would make more sense.
Almost certainly came from Pecos first downstream and then back up the Rio Grande.
Okay.
Some other work we've done with other species that live in the Pecos and Canadian basins suggest that there may have been a stream capture event, who knows how long ago, that put some fish in the Canadian or vice versa in the Pecos.
Do you guys ever interact with the Guzman Beautiful Shiner or Chihuahua Chub folks?
Yeah, Robert's just down the hall.
Okay.
I was going to have you like do a fun comparison between those fish and which one's the most beautiful, which one's the best.
I mean, the silvery minnows is definitely the most beautiful. The beautiful shiner, they only named it that because it's not that because beautiful and they wanted people to like it.
Okay. Nobody likes those bright blue and red fish at all. It's too colorful.
We have arm wrestling events usually weekly to try to decide these things.
Good. Yeah, it's important.
I didn't mention it when we were doing that episode, Katrina, but there's also a fish called the pretty shiner. It's in a different genus. It's in Lathrurus. We need to do some fish from that genus sometime, whether it's like Pine Woods or Ozark Mountain or something.
Okay. That'd be fun.
With this kind of historic fish assemblage, so you mentioned like the Rio Grande shiner isn't in the Rio Grande anymore, but you imply that it's elsewhere. Is it in the wild somewhere? Is it only in captivity? Where can you find these fish still hanging on?
They're in the Pecos River.
Okay.
And they were I've seen them even in Texas in the Big Bend area, and I think they're extirpated from there now. So it is really just in the Mexico section of the Pecos River in maybe 150 to 200 miles where there's a lot of problems there as well, but it's more intact than the middle Rio Grande. There's not the same amount of flood control that is going on over there. There's definitely water regulation for irrigation, but the amount of modifying the actual stream channel is much less compared to the middle Rio Grande.
All right.
What are the main crops folks are growing out there? Like what's being irrigated?
Obviously green chili capital of the world. There's a lot of alfalfa too for livestock feed. We have large pecan orchards throughout the middle Rio Grande.
There are a lot of like small scale farmers that grow more, human food crops, but vast majority is probably alfalfa. And then if you go farther south, there are some pretty large chili plantations.
You guys got some good green chilies. I can't deny that. I don't know if it's worth a species, but they're pretty good.
Don't let Colorado try to tell you that they're the green chili capital of the world. Those are fighting words.
Give us your 30-second elevator speech about why this fish is awesome and why we should care.
Thomas, go.
It's this really unique reproductive strategy that, is really indicative of how things have changed over the past 100 to 400 years. And I think it's just a question of like, how natural do you want the system to be and how managed do you want it to be? And where's the balance in the middle? Like, I think that is maybe one of the most interesting questions is, can we find a balance where we can have our green chilies and our alfalfa and figure out how to keep the fish around as well?
Okay. Andy?
I thought I punted.
Okay. Giving you one more chance.
I mean, the reproductive strategy is my favorite part about this fish, too.
All right. Well, thank you. That's super interesting.
Appreciate it.
Sounds like a really cool fish. We'll get out there and live from, discover, and enjoy all the fish, especially the very cool pelagic spawning Rio Grande silvery minnow. Thanks for listening to Fish of the Week. This podcast is a production of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Alaska Region. We hope you continue to develop your interest and love for America's fish and the beautiful places they live.
This is statewide news from Alaska Public Media. I'm Ava White. Without a single vote to spare, the U.S. House passed a mega bill early Thursday that's chock full of Republican priorities. It includes tax cuts, oil development in Alaska's Arctic, and cuts to Medicaid and food assistance for needy families. Alaska Public Media's Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports.
Like nearly all Republicans, Alaska Congressman Nick Begich voted for the budget reconciliation bill, now officially titled the One Big Beautiful Bill Act.
This is a great bill for Alaska. It preserves the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, so it keeps taxes low for working Americans, working Alaskans. It also drives some accountability in some of the government programs that are safety net programs.
Critics say the bill is devastating for the social safety net. Nationally, the budget reconciliation bill cuts almost $100 billion a year from Medicaid, a public health insurance program, and SNAP, sometimes called food stamps. It shifts some of those costs to the states. If it becomes law, states for the first time would have to pay a percentage of SNAP benefits based on each state's rate of payment error. That would hit particularly hard in Alaska, which has the highest error rate in the country, stemming from a huge backlog in cases it struggled to clear. Alaska could be on the hook for 25% of SNAP benefits, or $63 million. Also, the bill would cut in half the amount the federal government pays the states to administer SNAP, a loss of nearly $6 million for Alaska.
We're struggling right now, and this would just be a bigger hit.
State Representative Genevieve Mina, an Anchorage Democrat, chairs the State House Committee on Health and Social Services.
I still receive constituent emails and emails from people in other districts that they've been waiting months for their Medicaid and for their SNAP. So it's this cascading impact.
About 1 in 10 Alaskans receive SNAP benefits to help them buy food. The program injects some $250 million a year into Alaska's economy through grocery purchases. State House Representative Zach Fields, another Anchorage Democrat, says there's no quick way to fix Alaska's difficulty administering the federal programs. Fields attributes the problem to worker vacancies, low salaries, and skimpy benefits.
This is such a profound challenge. It's absolutely not something we can solve by the time these proposed mandates and the budget reconciliation proposal would come down on us.
Congressman Begich says he supports measures to ensure Alaska and other states abide by the rules of the safety net programs. He notes that Alaska's cost share of SNAP could drop from 25% to 5% if it improves its error rate.
A number of other states have gotten it right, and I think that we need to look to other states for how we go about ensuring that the people that are receiving the benefit are properly vetted.
The bill includes a wide array of Republican priorities. It would require new oil lease sales in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and in Cook Inlet. House leaders at the last minute dropped a section to promote development in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. They also removed a section approving the Ambler Road. The reconciliation bill goes next to the Senate, where it can pass with just Republican votes, but several Republicans have said they don't like it. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
This is Alaska Public Media.
See the ruin on the hill, where the smoke is hanging still, like an echo of an age long forgotten. There's a story of a home crushed beneath those blackened stones, and the roof that fell before the beams were rotten. Cecil Darby loved his wife, and he labored all his life to provide her with material possessions. And he built for her a home of the finest wood and stone, and the building soon became his sole obsession. Oh, it took 300 days for the timbers to be raised, and the silhouette was seen for miles around. And the gables reached as high as the eagles in the sky, but it only took one night to bring it down. When Darby's castle tumbled to the ground. Though they shared a common bed, there was precious little said in the moments that were set aside for sleeping. For his busy dreams were filled with the rooms he'd yet to build, and he never heard young Helen Darby weeping. Then one night he heard a sound as he laid his pencil down, and he traced it to her door and turned the handle. And the pale light of the moon through the window of the room split the shadows where two bodies lay entangled. Oh, it took 300 days for the timbers to be raised, and the silhouette was seen for miles around, and the gable reached as high as the eagles in the sky, but it only took one night to bring it down. When Darby's castle tumbled to the ground.
What you need most of all, so the door is always open and the light's on in the hall. Yes, the door is always open and the light's on in the hall. And you know that I'll be waiting if you ever come to call. When night falls on that mansion and you're lying in his bed, when he begs you for attention, will you think of me instead? When he reaches out to touch you, is your face turned to the wall? Well, the door is always open and the light's on in the hall. Yes, the door is always open and the light's on in the hall. And you know that I'll be waiting if you ever come to call. Yes, the door is always open and the light's on in the hall.
The sun is up. There's a stir across the land, and so begins another day on life's highway. On city streets, down country roads, like a stream the people flow. There's bread to win and toast to pay on life's highway. There is hope with every turn, a bridge to build, a bridge to burn. Here's hoping you never go astray on life's highway. We are young, then we're old, passing through, then passing on. Like the roses bloom and fade on life's highway. Step by step, round and round, never knowing where we're bound. From the grave highway. There is hope with every turn, a bridge to build, a bridge to burn. Here's hoping you never go astray on life's highway. The sun is up, time's at hand. There's a stir across the land, and so begins another day on life's highway.
Mama, It's so good to be back home again. I'm so proud to see that you are looking well. Yes, I know that I look a little weary. Oh, but Mama, I have been through living hell. Mama, you know how much I've always loved her. Well, she done things to me I couldn't understand. Why she parked one night in our driveway with a stranger, where I could see her making love to him. Oh, if I lose my mind, Mama, I wanna be here with you. Have them lock me up, but see, I have good care. I just couldn't stand the torture any longer. I was afraid of what I'd do if I stayed there. Oh, Mama, she told me that her love had gone. How I wish that I had left way back then. But my love for her would not let me believe it. Just like it won't let me forget seeing them. Oh, if I lose my mind, Mama, I wanna be here with you. Have them lock me up, but see, I have good care. I just couldn't stand the torture any longer. I was afraid of what I'd do if I stayed there. I was afraid of what I'd do if I stayed there.
Well, I ain't afraid of dying. It's the thought of being dead. I wanna go on being me once my eulogy's been read. Don't spread my ashes out to sea. Don't lay me down to rest. You can put my mind at ease if you fill my last request. Pop me up beside the jukebox if I die. Lord, I wanna go to heaven, but I don't wanna go tonight. Fill my boots up with sand, put a stiff drink in my hand. Prop me up beside the jukebox if I die. Just let my headstone be a neon sign. Just let it burn. If I die.